Hello and welcome to Resilience, the global adaptation podcast, the show where we'll be exploring the best solutions and cutting-edge technologies for adapting to climate change.
From climate-resilient forests to the use of artificial intelligence to the power of storytelling, we're coming to you from the United Nations Environment Programme. I'm Liz Bernhardt.
And I'm Marcus Neild. In our podcast, we'll be talking to the world's greatest adaptation experts, but we'll also be travelling around the world to meet people on the front lines of climate change to hear personal stories of how they've built resilience.
We're really excited to share some incredible climate success stories with you. Join us as we adapt to climate change, one conversation at a time.
Stories have been part of human culture since the dawn of civilization. They captivate our imagination, trigger our emotions, and share messages in a way that statistics and data alone cannot. From our ancient myths and legends to our blockbuster films and news headlines and podcasts, stories are one of the most fundamental ways humans make sense of the world.
And when it comes to climate change, sharing personal stories and shining a light on the human faces behind the statistics can actually humanize the issue. Whether it's learning about a farmer that's battling drought or a mother trying to protect her home from floods. And I think the way that the media more generally covers climate is important to think about, but it raises tough questions. Is adaptation getting the spotlight that it deserves? And are the right stories being told that can motivate us to act?
So today we'll explore with our two guests how filmmakers and journalists are reporting and covering the world's race to adapt to climate change. Chris Flavelle is the climate adaptation reporter at the New York Times, while Malaika Vaz is an explorer and filmmaker using visual storytelling to bring the climate crisis to life. We'll start by talking with Chris about why he chose to focus his reporting on adaptation specifically, what makes a climate story go viral, and his award-winning coverage of the growing crisis in the home insurance industry in the US, an adaptation topic that a lot of people just haven't quite grasped how important this is and will be. So Chris, so you are one of the first reporters to focus on climate adaptation, which you started at Bloomberg in 2016. So what made you want to focus on that topic? Was there a sort of particular light bulb moment that triggered it?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I appreciate you having me on to talk about this. I had been covering climate change at Bloomberg through the second Obama administration. And this is a time when the US government was pushing ever more aggressively to cut emissions. And I couldn't shake the sensation that as hard as the US government pushed on that, it seemed hard to imagine a situation in which global emissions fell enough to avert really significant consequences. And it seemed like those efforts to adapt would only become more important. And also, it had one more source of appeal to me, which was that in the US, it seemed at the time as though the debate over climate adaptation was much less polarized than the debate over emissions. And it seemed like instead of it being sort of a political football, the debate over how to adapt to climate shocks was much more focused on what works. There wasn't a clear sort of left-right divide. And then by 2017, what had become sort of a working theory that adaptation and resilience would get more important in the US was very strongly confirmed. We had first Hurricane Harvey, and then Hurricane Irma, and then Hurricane Maria, and then disastrous wildfires throughout the West. And it really quickly in the US, you switched to the problem is now, and we have to figure out what we can do now. And fast forward to today, even I am surprised by how quickly the problem has gotten worse in terms of the number of disasters, the scale of disasters, the way those disasters ripple through the US economy. So the speed with which this challenge is accelerating and taxing our ability to adapt astounds me. It sounds terrible to say this, but I wish I hadn't been as right about this.
Absolutely. Well, you were clearly way ahead of the curve there. And just to add to that, the UN Secretary General calls for 50% of all climate finance to be devoted to adaptation. And right now, it's only around 5% or something like that. So if we increase the amount of climate finance as a whole, which we absolutely must, and ensure that 50% of that finance goes to adaptation instead of 5%, the scale at which adaptation is going to grow is really clearly quite extraordinary. So, Chris, in your work as an adaptation journalist, what would you say are some of the key things you've learned about adaptation from your reporting?
One of the through lines of my reporting is there are levels of adaptation. Basic adaptation is fortifying the built environment, trying to invest money in making infrastructure and communities more resilient. I think the verdict on that is mixed. So far from my reporting, there's been a lot of money spent on that in the US. It's less clear just how significant the return has been on that. And one counter is, well, these things take a lot of time. But I think it's still fair to be skeptical and just wonder if the goal is to basically fortify and make resilient existing communities, existing patterns of life, how plausible is that? And we don't know.
And do you think the issue there is more about we need to improve the way that we assess success? Or do you think it's just sort of like inherently difficult to measure the impact of that?
Based on my reporting of the US federal agencies that are most involved, one legitimate criticism is it's not always clear that the sort of measure of success has been well thought through. You can imagine success being defined in all kinds of ways. It could be fewer casualties or deaths during disasters. It could be reduced losses in terms of property. It could be reduced disruptions to life or business. Those things can look different and can operate at odds to one another. It's not really clear to me that the agencies that work on this have decided what their metric for success is, rather than just spending money on this stuff.
Right. Okay. So at UNEP, when we communicate about adaptation, something that we're often trying to do is showcase successful initiatives that have worked really well. And part of that is to show what can be achieved. But we're often finding that, you know, there's this balance that has to be struck between, you know, just essentially so we don't present adaptation as this kind of silver bullet. Do you think about that balance in your own writing, conveying the urgency on one hand, but then making sure that you're showing people that, you know, change is possible and there are some things that work?
I see my job as to inform my readers about what's happening and what it means. And so the first order of business in the US is there's so many efforts underway to adapt to climate shocks. And I spend my time trying to find the most important ones and explain them. I think where the debate is now is not should we try to adapt, it's how should we try to adapt and how can we adapt more specifically in a smart way that is sort of financially effective, some degree of efficiency, and doesn't produce new problems. Classic example, and it hasn't been solved, is if you take a flood-prone coastal community and spend money to make it more resilient and fortified against flooding or storm surge, are you also creating a perverse incentive to encourage people to stay there? You know, versions of that challenge of short-term adaptation potentially leading to long-term exacerbation of the problem, that exists, I think, everywhere.
So how do you see, this is kind of getting a little bit onto the impact that the media coverage has, do you see cases where media coverage has gone on to affect adaptation policies or practices?
There's definitely objectively been a pretty significant shift in the US in terms of the federal government and some state governments spending more money and time focused on adaptation than was the case 2 or 5 or certainly 10 years ago. Is that the result of media coverage? I don't know. My guess is it's the result of changes in the real world. In that sense, probably the job of journalists is the same for climate coverage as anything else. We try to tell the most important stories. And if the system works, then a more informed public demands better action from its leaders.
So in terms of which adaptation stories go viral and which don't, have you noticed any trends?
Just looking at my own stories and areas of coverage, stories where people can see their own experience or where something is tangible and feels real can tend to elicit a stronger reaction. So for example, My team is working this year on a series of stories about home insurance in the U.S. and how climate change is affecting the home insurance industry, both in terms of making it harder to get and also more expensive where it is available. And I think that resonates because most people in the U.S. own a home. And if you own a home, you have to have insurance generally. The other thing that stands out is I think people want to come away from a news story that they've learned something they didn't know.
Yeah.
And so my goal as I approach my coverage is to always be on the lookout for stories that will feel new or surprising. And so stories that capture some element of the climate adaptation struggle in a new or surprising way can resonate more strongly than something that, though important, people may feel like they've heard it before.
You mentioned home insurance. Could you help us understand a little bit why this has such huge implications for building climate resilience?
It would be difficult to overstate the importance of the insurance industry to the U.S. economy, and I'm sure to the economies of most countries around the world. If you don't have access to home insurance in the U.S., you can't get a mortgage. If you can't get access to a mortgage, you can't buy a home. At some point, even if insurers are still able to price the growing risk attached to climate change, at some point, that price becomes too high.
Yeah.
And the market fails for a different reason. You know, one thing people have told me in my reporting is you can imagine the crisis facing the insurance industry as sort of a forcing mechanism to compel governments to get more aggressive about where and how we build homes.
And so here's a question that we ask all our guests that come on, Chris. So what would you say is the biggest adaptation topic right now that no one is talking about?
If you'll allow me to reframe that ever so slightly, just what's the most perhaps adaptation topic that doesn't get as much attention as it should? My newspaper has done a great job this year covering extreme heat. And the reason I think that coverage is so important is just physically, there's a pretty strict limit to how much the human body can adapt to heat. For most of us who are lucky enough to spend most of our day indoors, the problem of extreme heat is serious, but sort of fundamentally a nuisance. For those who can't make those choices, who have to be outside, there's a real issue, especially in cities around the U.S. and much of the world, where you are going to experience really hot days on a regular basis. And I note that first because the scale of that problem is so enormous. And again, obviously not just in the U.S., around the world. How do you maintain a functional agricultural economy in places where working during harvest time is dangerous? I have yet to hear good ideas about that. And the list beyond that is probably endless. I wrote a piece, for example, earlier this year about wildfire smoke and how almost uniquely among climate threats, adapting at the community level to wildfire smoke is really hard because it's hard to predict where the smoke will go. It's hard to build community level infrastructure, right? Really, you're talking about protecting people in their homes, and the smoke isn't always visible. And the consequences don't happen right away. I wrote that piece. It's a striking example of how there's almost an endless number of climate shocks. All of the climate shocks that I've ever covered, there's always something that individuals or businesses or governments can do beyond what they're doing. But as I try to make clear in my stories, there are limits to that adaptation or there are trade-offs.
So Chris, just one final thing. How can people find your work online?
The most important thing you can do is subscribe to the New York Times, right? You get all the most important news that matters to this and every other topic. And be sure to read the stuff that my team produces. It's all available at nytimes.com/climate. If you wanted, you could find my stuff specifically. I've got a bio page, just my name. But look, the most important thing, and I really want to stress this, is I urge anyone who's listening to make sure they're getting their news on climate change from a good range of independent news sources, because this topic is so important that I just hope everyone takes the time to stay informed. And that starts with reading the New York Times.
All right, that was Chris Flavelle from the New York Times, who was giving us a glimpse into how the media covers and reports on climate adaptation. And next up, we have Malaika Vaz from India. Malaika is a filmmaker and an explorer who's traveled the world to tell stories of how communities are experiencing climate change and environmental degradation and what they're doing to adapt and increase their resilience. Malaika founded her own film production house and by the age of 16 had already explored both the Arctic and the Antarctic. She's seen firsthand how climate change affects some of the most vulnerable, but also the most resilient people on Earth. Hey, Malaika, welcome to the show. We're so glad you've joined us. Can you take us to the moment when you first wanted to be an environmental filmmaker?
I would say that it's often an amalgamation of different moments, but I know that as a young child growing up on the west coast of India, I had this strange dream to go to all seven continents before I was 18. And so as a competitive windsurfer at the time and as a scuba diver, I traveled quite a bit. And then I realized that the two continents that I hadn't been to were, you know, North America with the Arctic and then the Antarctic. So I reached out to the National Center for Antarctic and Oceanographic Research in India and asked them if I could join the expedition. And of course, I was 14 at the time, so they said, you're way too young. But there are these other expeditions that take students from across the world, and you get to assist climatologists and scientists in the polar region. So I think that was one of the first experiences that I had that really helped me understand that my calling was telling stories, and specifically telling stories about nature. Because when you're in the Antarctic or when you're in the Arctic, surrounded by the most beautiful places, the most pristine spots on Earth, I think it really touches you at a very personal level. And then when you begin to learn about the challenges that these ecosystems face, it inspires you to think about how connected our ecosystems are and how protecting the Arctic and the Antarctic is one big aspect of protecting nature at large. So I kind of came back from those expeditions really interested in telling stories about nature back home in my own country.
I think it's incredible that you had the foresight at that young age to know that that's something you wanted to do and have the perseverance. As a mom of teenage kids myself, I can say that I find that really amazing and very inspiring.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that really impacted me personally about that is realizing that the kind of nuance that you see is sometimes very different from what's on television. And as a filmmaker, I really wanted to represent that. Like, for example, the fact that, you know, when you have decreasing sea ice, that doesn't just mean that it has environmental impacts on polar bears. It also means that it is resulting in oil and gas companies going into these pristine natural ecosystems. And very often, actually, these shipping routes that are emerging are having a direct impact on the climate. So it's kind of this vicious cycle that's fueled.
Yeah, and your experience, Malaika, in the Arctic and Antarctic regions is really, really interesting, because obviously we know in the climate change world that the speed of change in these parts of the world is just so rapid. And I think it's just a really interesting part of the world to look at. And obviously, this is a show all about resilience. And you could argue, really, that some of the most resilient people on the planet are indigenous communities in the Arctic region. So I'd be really interested to know a little bit more about these communities. And did you get a chance yourself to see how they adapt and thrive in their environment? And if so, were there any sort of particular stories or particular people that come to mind?
So when I was in the Canadian and Greenlandic Arctic, I remember meeting communities that completely depended on their natural resources. And I remember when we were in the Greenlandic Arctic, we went into this small little community. There were about 500 people. And the day that we arrived, they'd actually hunted a seal. And we saw a family using every aspect of that body. And it was really incredible to see how there was sustainability at the very core of this hunting practice. But on the other hand, we were also understanding how the changing climate in the Arctic was directly impacting their food. And while, you know, now it's almost a ceremonial thing that still happens as a way to uphold culture, it is so much harder for these communities to depend on nature. There is data that says that about 7 out of 10 kids in Nunavut in Canada live in food insecure households. And these are kids whose ancestors used to be able to provide for themselves and often had excess that they could then share with their community. And wherever I've gone since then in the last couple of years, I've really seen how when you meet the communities who are on the front lines, you see that when it comes to their livelihoods, all of those are directly impacted by climate change.
So Malaika, obviously a huge amount must go into these filmmaking projects that you do, and it must not be easy as well, especially when you think about some of the regions that are most impacted by climate change. If you think about it, a lot of them are quite remote, can be quite hard to get to. What would you say are some of the challenges that you've faced when trying to capture the true impact of climate change, both on ecosystems, but also on human lives as well?
Telling these stories is the greatest privilege. We get to go to the most beautiful places. We get to be welcomed and have the privilege of time that people share with us. I also do think that in our world, it's very easy to talk about that time that we were undercover in China filming a dangerous story or working in dangerous places in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Those stories are great. But as I get older, I've realized that as a filmmaker, I also do have the option of coming back home to New York City. I think my filmmaking practice has really changed to make sure that we have real community engagement in the production process, but we have leaders from the community be producers. We have, you know, cinematographers from the communities. And we make sure that everyone that we work with is working on the production in a really equitable and respectful way where their perspectives matter just as much as the team that gets to leave and goes back home. The hard challenge really is taking difficult, complex narratives into the public domain. When you come home from a long day of work, very often you want to get back and watch something light and entertaining. And I think that a climate change story sometimes doesn't fit into that category. So for us as storytellers, it's a very exciting challenge of making sure that we're innovating and figuring out ways to make these sometimes difficult stories exciting. And that, I think, is something that I really appreciate about my craft. And increasingly, what we're doing is also making sure that we're working on follow-up impact campaigns that bring in different stakeholders and ensure that the impact of the film really begins after the broadcast date and that you can really see that both at the grassroots level and at the policy level.
That's so important that we're not just broadcasting these kinds of shows to the converted. I think you talked about, and I have such a respect for the craft that you have and the fine lines between very current issues and the longer trend, right? Global issues and local issues. I think another fine line is between, you know, showing the gravity of the situation, but also the need to avoid sensationalizing it or exploiting those who are suffering from these impacts. How do you find that balance?
So honestly, it really is about the process. One thing that I'm always thinking about is how do we make sure that we're being the best filmmakers? What does it mean like to go into a community and respectfully engage, get to know them, get to know their story, and maybe even take the cameras out after a day of just hanging out? I think that it's that friendship at the core of those interactions that really helped me to connect deeply. And then the other thing is that when it comes to telling these stories for global audiences, it's important to have a stock take and understand what stories are working, what stories aren't working. And we're seeing such a big demographic shift as well with storytelling, where 50 years back, we had mostly people tuning into their televisions and watching long-form programming. And now people have their phones and they want to watch short stuff. I mean, I have a brother who's significantly younger, so I know that he wouldn't watch most of my documentaries, but he will watch the cutdowns when they come out on Instagram, right? So I know that it's important to engage those younger audiences.
Thinking about just the span of your work, one of the things that I'd be really interested to hear, can you describe a situation where you witnessed the resilience or the adaptation of a community in the face of climate change?
So recently we were working on a documentary with National Geographic Society, and one of the locations that we went to was Louisiana. Now, Louisiana has really been battered over multiple decades by different climate catastrophes and natural disasters. And there's a specific area where you can basically see a lot of indigenous communities have been impacted, and many of them have had to also move out. But what's really interesting is that for these communities, they have actually adapted in really interesting ways by focusing a lot of their conservation efforts on land restoration, on making sure that there is, you know, regenerative efforts when it comes to protecting nature. And I think that's super exciting because it shows us the power of nature-based solutions in combating the climate crisis. We need to have communities at the very forefront when it comes to leading the charge, whether it is in Louisiana, whether it is in India, in the wetlands. And I think that when you have communities at the forefront, they completely understand what's required. And that just means that these projects are going to live longer. They're going to have that longevity that is so critical when it comes to climate change mitigation and adaptation.
That's super interesting, Malaika. One of the things I'd love to ask you is, what are you really excited about in terms of this topic of storytelling and filmmaking to drive action on the environment or climate change? Like, is there anything particular that you're really excited about coming up on the horizon?
We are working on natural history projects that really represent the beauty of the natural world. We're working on documentaries that show the human footprint on our planet. And we're working on intersectional films that really represent how there are these solutions out there. And I'm excited in the next decade to tell more stories of solutions that are really working. I think solutions-oriented journalism can provide audiences with so much hope.
I think that solutions-oriented storytelling that provides people hope should be the tagline of our podcast. I don't think we could agree with you any more than how you put it. But like, I only have one more question for you, and that's, how can our audience find out more about your work?
So you can follow our production company's work at untamedplanet.in and see some of the films that we're putting out there for different television networks across the world. And yeah, we would love to have more people tuning in to the shows on TV, watching them when they're on streamers, and really engaging with this content.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Malaika.
Thank you for having me, Liz and Marcus.
Great. That was Malaika Vaz from Untamed Planet, sharing what it's like to capture stories of environmental degradation and adaptation. And earlier in the episode, we got to hear from Chris Flavelle about how the media gives context to adaptation, how to report accurately on the challenge, and why some stories gain traction and others don't. And he even covered the link to the home insurance crisis
that's bubbling up right now
in the U.S.
As a climate communicator myself, I have to say I've really enjoyed doing this episode. And I think it's worth remembering that we all carry and create stories. It's not just the professional storytellers who work in the media. Telling stories is an innate human impulse, arguably one of the defining traits of our species. We're going to leave you with a quote from the writer, historian, and columnist Rebecca Solnit. She says, "Every crisis is in part a storytelling crisis. This is as true of climate chaos as anything else. We are hemmed in by stories that prevent us from seeing or believing in or acting on the possibilities for change. Some are habits of mind. Some are industry propaganda. Sometimes the situation has changed, but the stories haven't, and people follow the old versions like outdated maps into dead ends." So, dear listeners, what's the climate story that you're going to tell?
So that's it from us today. Thanks so much to Chris. Thank you to Malaika. And of course, thank you to all of you who are listening. Join us next time as we adapt to climate change, one conversation at a time.
This show is funded by the Japanese Ministry of the Environment.
Richard Myron is the producer, and this has been an Earshot Strategies production.